I speak of it every year. The High Holy Days are all about contemplating your mortality, in a sense preparing for your own death. This is especially true on Yom Kippur. Think about all the imagery. We continually refer to the Book of Life. We wish each other L'shana Tova Tikatevu, may be written for a good year. And after Rosh Hashanah, we wish each other Gamar Chatima Tova, may you be well sealed in the Book of Life. We chant, read, think about, and maybe even have nightmares about the Unatana Tokev prayer, where we imagine that somehow our fate may be sealed for the next year. We shun the normal functions of life, eating, drinking, intimacy, working. You know, in some ways, being a rabbi is a lot like other jobs I have. I work hard, I write a lot, I talk a lot, I struggle with computers and copiers, I'm on the phone, I'm busy with meetings and travel and so on. But in many ways, being a rabbi is nothing like my prior work as a physicist and a businessman. Being a rabbi brings me face to face with life and death, joy and sadness, rejoicing and mourning, tears of happiness and tears of despair, often on the same day, sometimes within the same hour. So I have a lot of experience with funerals and the process that surrounds them. Sometimes I'm called when a loved one's health is failing. I've been at their bedsides in their last moments. Sometimes I've known them for years as friends and congregants. Sometimes I've only known their relative who has called me to conduct the service. Sometimes it's hospice or the mortuary that calls me when the family has no rabbi locally. In any event, I spend time with the family and friends, perhaps on the phone, but more often face to face, in order to try and get to know them and their loved one who has entered eternity. I then try and pull this information together into a chesed, a eulogy. Sitting with a family at the time of their loss is an awful, that is filled with awe, an awesome experience. Yes, I'm there to get some basic information, critical biographical milestones, names and relationships of loved ones left behind, Hebrew name and so on. But more than that, I am there to absorb, to try and feel the emotion of the assembled family and friends, to get a deeper sense of the person who has just crossed over. Scenes at these homes range from almost unspeakable grief and shock to more calm and quiet tears, and even to the laughter of recalling wonderful moments gone by. I never know what to expect, but I never fail to get a feeling for the soul of the departed. In a way, the assembled family is like a jigsaw puzzle with a piece removed. By examining the borders of that empty space, the missing piece, the shape of the departed's life and characters revealed too by photos on the wall, books on the shelf, hobbies scattered about, and in the intensity of words, tears, and the laughter of those left behind. In the course of planning the eulogy, I almost always invite the family and friends to say a few words of memory during the funeral service, and most often they do so. It is a powerful experience and a privilege to listen to these words. They always are heartfelt and therefore are always eloquent. As the Hasidic saying goes, words from the heart enter the heart. They are often choked and interrupted with tears, making them more eloquent, notwithstanding the apologies of the speakers. The speakers are painfully aware that they have only a few precious moments to summarize a life, to express their deepest feelings, to shine some light on the darkness of death. They often begin with the words, "Bear with me," as they invite all of us to literally help them bear their burden of grief. It has struck me that we have much to learn from these reflections, which so beautifully capture the essence of life and love. Therefore, for the last decade or so, I've started taking notes while friends and family members are speaking at funerals. I think that someday this might be worth pulling together into a book called What I've Learned About Life from Funerals. But since I'm still in the process, I offer tonight a sermon called What I'm Learning About Life from Funerals. It draws upon moments that I've spent with your loved ones on their deathbeds, moments with you as we prepare for the funeral, as well as words spoken at the funeral itself. First, let me tell you what I almost never hear. I almost never hear about professional or business success, about how much money someone has, or how many cars or houses or boats or motorcycles. I do hear about passion for work and career. But I've never seen a widow or child wipe away a tear of gratitude thinking about the year Dad brought home that incredible bonus after missing all of our birthdays and soccer games. I almost never hear about how much children appreciated the great and expensive vacations that they went on, or the new cars, or the 75-inch 3D Ultra HD plasma TVs they were given, or the diamond rings or the brooches that were given. I only hear about priceless gifts of time and love. Here's some good news. I never hear about how someone was able to stick to their diet or to their budget. For example, here's some sage wisdom about nutrition, health, and marriage, quoted from a man who only managed 62 years of marriage and almost 90 years of living. He said, and I quote, "I believe in a strict diet of salami, limiting smoking to no more than 3 packs a day, and when I feel the need to exercise, I lie down until it goes away." I've never heard anyone on their deathbed regret that they did not spend enough time at the office or did not go far enough in their career. And now let me tell you what I hear that most touches me. A child speaking about a parent who told her the ugly duckling story over and over again to boost the young girl's self-image. About the warmth and joy of working together with a grandparent on a project, any project, just to be with him. About a mom whose greatest skill was making do, finding quarters in phone booths for snacks, saving the plastic from the cleaners to be used when it rains, and always coming up with some small gift, even when it was clearly not in the budget. I hear about how proud children and grandchildren were to share their successes with their loved mom, dad, Bubby, or Zeta. On a world-famous architect's deathbed, his daughter asked him, "Dad, of all the things that you've done in the world, which is the one that you're leaving behind that you feel makes your life worthwhile?" She was certain he would point to one of his world-famous award-winning buildings. But without a second's hesitation, he looked in her eye and said, "You, of course." Of a son-in-law asking his failing father-in-law, "Do you know my name?" And hearing, "I can't think of it, but I know that I love you very much." Of a mother teaching her daughter that grandchildren are the prize for raising your children well. Of a granddaughter recalling how, as a young child, she tentatively asked, "Grandma, if I learn to read, will you still sit next to me?" Of a husband acknowledging that it was his wife that taught him to say, "I love you." You know, I always hear about the passions. I almost never hear that Grandpa was just an average nice guy. I hear about family legends, about the trademark sayings that were not always well received in life, but will now be sorely missed. My own father of blessed memory would often, and I mean very often, say, "There are only two kinds of people in this world, Lotkers and those who want to be Lotkers." He would also say, "Everyone is entitled to my opinion." To us kids, when we were crying over some unfair decision, he gently said, "Better you should cry now than I should cry later." Think about it. I would hear a legend about a father or grandfather who would end, or at least try to end, every argument with his pronouncements, "The real answer is..." I hear about legends of growing up in small towns and big towns, of going to school in a horse-drawn cart, astoundingly simple and mundane things, about songs and jokes. I hear of the almost legendary care with which one approached being seen in the world, never wanting to be seen without the proper makeup, less than fully dressed, hair done just right, and nails beautifully polished. I hear about legendary friendliness, about how to know him was to love him, about how she was able to make close friends within minutes, about how she attracted friends like mosquitoes, about how even in the hospital, His smile, his sense of humor, his warmth made him special to doctors, nurses, and staff alike. Here's how one daughter put it. If you got on the elevator with my dad, by the third floor you were acquaintances, and by the ninth, old friends. And of course there were legends about mamas and bubbies fretting about what their babies were, or more importantly, were not eating, with due concern about children starving in China. I hear stories of dedication, of a wife actually living beside her husband's hospital bed for weeks and more to make sure that his care did not miss a beat. Of dad holding down two or three jobs so they could afford to live in an area with good schools. I hear the sweetest, most beautiful memories of bear hugs given and received, of the feeling of safety in daddy's lap, of the smell of aftershave in a morning hug, of laughter and love around Bubby's kitchen, of traditional meals, Thanksgiving rituals, chicken soup, or whatever the prize-winning recipe happened to be, of memories of fresh-squeezed orange juice and homemade cookies, of small children dancing on their parents' feet, of the certainty that daddy could fix anything, even though, as it turned out, daddy was in reality almost helpless with tools, of the funny sound someone's aunt made when she sneezed, of smiles, smiles, and more smiles, in photos as well as in life, of how welcome the nervous son-in-law or daughter-in-law felt, and how beautifully they were accepted in spite of their differences. As one daughter-in-law put it recently, with them there were no in-laws, just family. Of grandma calling her adult granddaughter at work at 8:01 a.m. every year to be the first to wish her a happy birthday. Of lying in bed, watching TV with grandparents, in this case, who had two TVs in their bedroom with separate earphones for grandma and grandpa, so each could watch their own separate program, but they could watch together. Of grandma's famously secret candy closet. Of the magic of spending a day with daddy, having him all to herself. Of the size and strength of grandpa's hands. Of a grown man speaking of how his mom would still cup his face in her hands and call him my little boy. I also hear what children and grandchildren learn, not by words but by deeds, of integrity, honesty, justice, of knowing right from wrong. Here's an example. One man said, once after a long day of work, I was trying to avoid going to a party. But I drove right past my home, guided only by the lesson that mom taught. Quote, when you're invited to a party and said you're going, always keep your promise, just as you would not want to be disappointed by someone else failing to show. It was at that party I met the woman who would become my wife. I hear about dedication to worthy causes, about passion, about love and devotion. I can't tell you how many times I hear about how grandma and grandpa were, most of all, dedicated to each other. About humor, and not always intentional. One daughter said about her mother, her home was always immaculate. After a social gathering, she would always insist on completely cleaning the home before going to bed. The reason she gave, what if a burglar came in and saw what a mess our home was? This was an amazing new variant on the always wear clean underwear in case of an accident theme. Another woman said, Mom passed away quietly in her sleep. This was the first and last thing she did quietly. And my husband called me his childhood sweetheart of his second childhood. Here's one. Grandma, a child of the Depression, had a series of cats, all named Shana. She didn't want to buy new name tags after each cat died. I hear of optimism. My father-in-law said that everything was the best chicken, the best restaurant, even when it clearly was not. He knew his life was the best. And perhaps most of all, children and grandchildren and friends and colleagues speaking highly of someone who could be counted upon to do what they say and to be there when needed. I hear no matter how long a couple was together, it was not long enough. Whether 5 years, 50 years, sometimes over 70 years. parting was still always too soon. Even when death was a blessed end to suffering and pain, it was still too soon. On those special occasions when I've spent time with my friends on their deathbed, I hear them speak about their pride in their children, their grandchildren, and accomplishment. I remember especially one lady who, looking back on her 103 years, was proud to have voted in every election since women got the vote. I hear about their lack of regrets, of love, love, and more love for spouses, children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. I always ask what advice can be given to all of us. Their response usually sounds something like to enjoy special moments, to appreciate what we have, to love one another. Of course, honesty dictates that I confess that not every party was so sweet. I have met some astoundingly dysfunctional families. One man who was so estranged from his family that none of them could be contacted on his passing, and that even his loving partner could not get his body released from the county morgue before a 30-day waiting period. I hear family members, even children and grandchildren, who have not been seen or heard from in decades and who are not mentioned in the Charlie Leaves Behind list. Of unresolved family tensions that continue to simmer through the funeral and even sometimes a year later at the unveiling. And all too often these revolve around money issues. So here's my perspective and what I'm learning from the funerals of people I love and people you love. Death is not the end. It's simply not acceptable or comprehensible that all this love, all this wisdom, all this energy, all this life could simply disappear, could simply be for naught. As I always remind you during funerals, Judaism has always held that there is an afterlife. It's the one thing that every Jewish movement throughout history has agreed upon, and they haven't agreed upon much. We just don't know the details because no one's back to tell us. I know so many Jews who are certain that we don't hold with the idea of an afterlife. And my private theory is that this may just be because the afterlife is so central to Christianity, our instinct is if it's important to them, we don't believe it at all. But there are Jewish beliefs concerning the afterlife, and they are wide-ranging and not necessarily consistent. The traditional Jewish belief is in physical resurrection and the day of the coming of the Messiah, which is why Judaism frowns on cremation. There's a mystic, Kabbalistic belief in Yugalei HaNefesh, reincarnation, that we come back in this world to continue our work and our learning. The rabbis spoke with awe about life in Olam Haba, the world to come. They spoke of the joy of Torah study with Moses, the Messiah, and even God leading Torah study. They spoke about souls on the other side of the curtain, knowing of what is going on in this world, and even of the possibility of communication between worlds. A favorite belief of my parents, and one that I love, is that our loved ones are up there somewhere looking out for us. There's a great legend in my own family. My younger brother lives in Miami, and when Hurricane Andrew literally tore through Miami years ago, it was on the yurt site of our mother, my brother's mother, my mother, our Bubby. We called her Bubby because of our kids. And of course he lit a candle, and they actually had to abandon the house. When they came back, later, you know, hours and hours and hours later, there was no roof on the house. There was several feet of water in the house, but the candle was still burning in the kitchen. So I cannot accept that death is the end and there is nothing after death. Of course, this is my belief. I can't scientifically prove it. But I've also learned that if the most important things in life are represented by those who know us best and love us best, and what they say in the few minutes they have at our funeral, then many of us are spending a lot of time on the wrong things. We may be working too hard at things we don't enjoy in order to buy things of fleeting value, when we might be better off spending more time finding out what those we love really value. I suspect that we ought to be spending more time touching and talking than instant messaging, Facebooking, and emailing. I suspect that we ought to be spending more time listening and loving than keeping up with CSI, Law and Order, Desperate Housewives, and Monday, Sunday, and Thursday Night Football. I suspect that we ought to be spending more time teaching and giving rather than buying and consuming. I've learned how people ache to have another hour, another day, another month, another year. Sometimes they long to say some things that are left unsaid. And so we need to realize that these are the good old days. These are the good old days. Someday we will look back on them with a tear in our eye. We need to stop now, tonight, tomorrow, as soon as possible, to reconnect with those we love and have loved. As I watch each of my friends being lowered to their final rest, I reflect upon the truth that you can't take it with you. There's a story, a Yom Kippur story, of the rabbi preaching about mortality and the idea that everyone in this village, it's a little village in Russia, he says, everyone in this village will die. And the crowd is appropriately sober. Except for one guy sitting in the front who's smiling and laughing and doesn't seem to get it. Later on, as the people are walking out, the rabbi asks this guy, I don't understand. Everyone else seemed to appreciate the idea of mortality. That everyone in the village is mortal and will die. The guy smiled and said, I don't live in this village. And so, my friends, as we enter this day of fasting and reflection, I remind you that Yom Kippur underlines our mortality. Yes, the death rate is still 100%. The 90th Psalm asks God, Limnot yamenu ken hoda'a v'navi l'bav chokhmah, to number our days, that we may get us a heart of wisdom. We get a heart of wisdom by realizing that our days are finite and numbered. Recently, I officiated at my 321st funeral, and 322 is on Sunday. Here's what I think. I suggest that we live our life fully conscious of how short life truly is. I suggest that we understand the incredible value of each wonderful day. I suggest that we appreciate how the simplest, most ordinary, caring, loving things we do just may be in the final analysis, and I do mean the final analysis, the sweetest, most precious, most powerful, and most memorable things we do. And I suggest that we remain conscious of all of the above when we make our day-to-day decisions concerning how to spend our precious hours. I wish you and everyone you love a happy and healthy New Year and a Yom Kippur of discovery, insight, and depth, and a tzom kav, an easy fast.